From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! While President Clinton hails the late Princess Diana's call for a ban on landmines, his administration tries to weaken the proposed treaty. And on the charts, off the covers, rock, racism, and rap, we look at the Nation magazine's issue on the national entertainment state, who controls the music. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The United States has handed over to Honduras once secret CIA documents about Honduran military repression and the disappearance of 184 dissidents in the 1980s. This according to a Honduran official yesterday. The official, named Commissioner Leo Valladares, is Honduras's top government human rights advocate. He strongly hinted at U.S. involvement in the repression of the leftists, saying military units accused in the case of the missing people were trained by U.S. advisors. Nearly 20 Honduran military officers are wanted in connection with the disappeared, who are presumed dead. Valladares said the documents had given some leads in the case of the missing activists. In the 1980s, Honduras was the site of the largest CIA mission in the hemisphere. At the time, right-wing death squads eliminated tens of thousands in El Salvador and Guatemala, and to a lesser degree in Honduras, which had no guerrilla uprising. The United States was deeply involved militarily in Central America. Meanwhile, in Oslo, more than 100 countries have begun crucial talks to hammer out a treaty for a global ban on anti-personnel landmines, which kill or maim an estimated 26,000 victims a year. Delegates and organizers said they're optimistic the 19-day conference will reach agreement on a text for a convention banning the use, export, production, and stockpiling of the deadly weapons. We'll have more on that in just a few minutes when we go to Oslo. On Capitol Hill, Congress is coming back to work after a month-long recess. The Senate returns today, the House tomorrow, and there are a lot of issues awaiting them. The main thing is passing 13 spending bills needed to keep the government running after October 1st, the start of the new fiscal year. Military spending, campaign finance, and welfare reform are also on the agenda. House Speaker Newt Gingrich will try to reassert his leadership after the botched attempt to unseat him earlier this summer. Gingrich is hoping to keep disgruntled conservative colleagues at bay and draw a distinction with Clinton in the minds of voters. He plans to press for more tax cuts, government aid for private schools, and minimum wage leeway, as he calls it, for those who hire people off welfare. Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott has to worry about a feud between two GOP senators, Richard Lugar and Jesse Helms, over President Clinton's nominee for ambassador to Mexico, former Massachusetts Governor William Weld. Vice President Al Gore was hard at work romancing the unions yesterday, a constituency that could be vital in a presidential campaign in the year 2000. Gore traveled to the banks of the Mississippi River yesterday to offer a rousing endorsement for a, quote, new unionism march in a Labor Day parade and give a union-boosting speech to 700 cheering activists. Gore ripped Republican critics of legislation that's raised the minimum wage 90 cents since October, including a 40-cent boost yesterday to $5.15 an hour. Gore was joined at the rally by AFL-CIO President John Sweeney and Labor Secretary Alexis Herman. He picked a Labor Day celebration in Illinois, which holds an important early primary, and just across the river from Iowa, where precinct caucuses launch the nomination process. This news from Detroit. The man who wants to head the Teamsters Union says a new election should be delayed until next spring. James Hoffa lost last December's election to Ron Kerry by 16,000 votes, but a court-appointed monitor overturned the results and has called a new vote in November. Hoffa tells a Michigan newspaper, the Oakland Press, his opponent wants a hurry-up election so Hoffa can't organize support. A spokesperson for Kerry says he's satisfied with the tentative schedule. In throwing out the earlier results, the monitor cited alleged fundraising abuses by Kerry's campaign. Kerry himself has not been accused of any wrongdoing. The widow of Guyanese President Chetty Jagan has accepted her party's nomination to run for his former post, this according to a top official. If elected, Janet Jagan would be the country's first female head of state. A Jewish-American nurse from Chicago, Jagan also would become Guyana's and the Caribbean's first foreign-born elected leader. Jagan accepted the nomination of the governing People's Progressive Party during a Sunday party meeting. She's served as prime minister, the country's highest post, since her husband died of a heart attack in March. His deputy, Sam Hines, succeeded him as president pending elections expected by November. And Colombian guerrillas attacked a police station and army post in a southern Colombian town, killing three police officers and a soldier before retreating into the jungle. About 100 rebels attacked the police station late Sunday in San Miguel, a small town 340 miles south of the capital of Bogota, near the border of Ecuador. And that's some of the news. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Delegates from more than 100 countries have gathered in Oslo, Norway, to begin crucial talks on a treaty outlawing anti-personnel landmines, which kill or maim as an estimated 26,000 people a year. Even though the big military powers, namely China, Russia, and the United States, have balked at international restrictions on landmines, delegates are still hopeful that the 19-day meeting will produce agreement on a convention banning the use, export, production, and stockpiling of the weapons. We now go to Oslo and are joined by Mary Wareham, who is the coordinator of the U.S. campaign to ban landmines. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, can you tell us what has happened over the last few days? Certainly it has gotten a lot more attention than it would have because of the death of Princess Diana, who has supported that ban.
That's right. The princess's untimely death has created a lot of media calls to this office for comments, including some from some reporters who are asking if it will now be called the Princess Diana Treaty. And while the princess was very important to this cause for drawing attention to the plight of landmine survivors in the countries she visited, like Angola and Bosnia, and drawing attention to the need for more demining and drawing attention to the need for a ban, it is the work of the thousand-strong NGOs in 60 countries which make up the international campaign to ban landmines, which has gotten us to where we are now in Oslo, Norway, at the brink of a ban treaty. It is our partnership with the other governments who are leading the so-called Ottawa process, which will see this treaty negotiated here over the next 3 weeks and signed in Ottawa, Canada, in the first week of December. So we're very happy to be here in Oslo, Norway, and to see so many countries from so many different parts of the world here and speaking out for a ban. Yesterday morning, we started off with a minute's silence in memory of Princess Diana. Then we had a short speech from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Minister of Foreign Affairs. Then we went through the rules and procedures of the conference, and an excellent president, a South African ambassador, Salibi, was elected as the president of the conference, a very dynamic, very energetic personality who really just wants to get down to work. And one of the first things he said was, "No square brackets, please. We are here to negotiate a simple but a comprehensive treaty banning the use, production, stockpiling, and transfer of anti-personnel landmines. And we've got 3 weeks to do that." And he's confident that he can get this through. So those are the upbeat notes, the positive notes of the opening of this conference.
Mary, can you talk about the role of the United States? On Sunday, I was watching President Clinton respond to the death of Princess Diana. One of the things he brought up was her support of a ban on landmines. And yet the U.S. administration has not been as supportive.
Well, when the president was elected, one of the first things he asked for at this conference was for countries who have come with proposals to change the treaty text to put them forward now, either yesterday or today.
You mean the president?
The president of the conference, the South African ambassador. The participation by the United States in this whole treaty process is rather late. President Clinton made up his mind on around the 19th of September, just 10 days ago, that the U.S. would participate here, and he issued a very short statement to that effect. What he did not say is that there is no change in our policy. the United States have come to Oslo with the baggage of their domestic policy, which is they want to continue using anti-personnel landmines. They want to continue using them in Korea, and they want to continue using the ones which are supposed to self-destruct or self-deactivate, the so-called smart mines. They want to continue using them indefinitely. And everybody here, I'm not just talking about the campaign, but the governments present, do not understand how they are all here in good faith. They have all undertaken the necessary steps to get rid of this weapon. Yet the United States has turned up without making any serious policy change domestically, and is now, as of 11 o'clock, just a couple of hours ago, unveiled their proposals for the treaty text. So they want this international treaty to have three main things in it. One is a geographic exception for Korea. Two is a exception for the self-destructing smart mines, so that this treaty does not ban all anti-personnel mines, but just the smart ones. And three, they would like to see the entry into force of this treaty delayed for a decade or more. And all of those three points are unacceptable, and I'm happy to say that in just the first two opening days of this conference, we have had very few states speak in support of them, and the majority of nations here have spoken out against these proposals. And it's unfortunate, but this is what we're going to be debating for the next 3 weeks, are how America can be accommodated into this treaty.
Tell us about smart mines. What are they?
Smart mines are mines which are supposed to self-destruct or self-deactivate. So they blow up, and if they don't blow up, then they automatically turn themselves off. The fundamental issue that we have with the so-called smart mines is that they're indiscriminate. While they're armed, they cannot tell the difference between a civilian or a soldier. And Senator Patrick Leahy from Vermont, who has been a leader on this issue, has got a favorite saying: show me a mine which is smart enough to distinguish between the footfall of a child, a five-year-old child, and a soldier. Fact is, while they're armed, they're still indiscriminate, and they will still blow up if anyone steps on them. So that is the main problem with them. The mines which the Americans want to keep, there are three main systems of mines, and they're mixed systems. They're mixed up with anti-tank mines. The Gator is an alligator mine system, the MOPMs mine system, and the Volcano mine system. And all the other countries have come here prepared to relinquish the use, production, stockpiling, and trade of all anti-personnel mines, and they don't want to start discussing these smart mines. They don't want to start discussing these mines which America has manufactured so that they can be dropped out of airplanes from a great height and onto the ground where they're then active. These mines cannot be marked or mapped or recorded, so you cannot keep civilians out of those areas. Therefore, they do not work. It is not an acceptable alternative, even an interim alternative.
We're talking to Mary Wareham, who's the coordinator of the U.S. campaign to ban landmines. She's in Oslo, Norway right now for the 19-day conference, crucial talks on the treaty outlawing anti-personnel landmines. As she said just a little while ago today, the United States unveiled its position, has just actually joined these negotiations after refusing to, and is calling for major exceptions, including allowing smart mines and allowing the mining of Korea. Given the death of Princess Diana and the sudden attention to the landmine ban that she supported, was the press critical this morning as the U.S. unveiled their plan?
We've been talking to the press all day, and I think that the American delegation has been very busy taking calls and speaking to them as well, trying to explain the reasons why they have come here without, you know, the good faith in that they intend to negotiate a true ban treaty. Because what the United States have come here to try and do is create a partial ban treaty. We have a Cambodian campaigner here who's calling it a fake ban treaty. You know, you either ban this weapon or you don't ban this weapon. And the majority of countries have banned this weapon at home, and they're just coming here to solidify that in an international document. But the United States has not gotten rid of mines at home, anti-personnel mines. Therefore, how can we walk in here and try and get rid of them internationally? You've got to do this from the bottom up.
Can you tell us about the corporations in this country? First of all, how many are there that manufacture landmines? About a few months ago, we had on the Vietnam Veterans Against the War and Human Rights Watch, which came out with a report on the manufacturers of the landmines.
Yeah, my employees, actually, the Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation in Washington, there was an excellent report released just a few months ago by Human Rights Watch identifying about 47 companies across the states who had been involved in the manufacturing of anti-personnel landmines. And before that report came out, there was a dialogue initiated by Human Rights Watch with the chief executive officers of those companies, which went on for a couple of months to see if we could not get them to renounce what they were doing and to renounce any future production, knowingly making these components and knowingly selling them for use in anti-personnel mines. And our great victory came when Motorola Corporation, whose chip had been found, and this was documented in a film documentary, a Motorola chip was found in a Chinese-made plastic mine. And Motorola at first was saying, oh, well, we don't know where our products end up. But we managed to get a very good statement out of them saying we will not knowingly sell our components if we know they are going to go into the manufacturing of anti-personnel mines, that we are not in this business and we renounce it. And we took Motorola's lead and went to all of these other companies, and I think to date about 17 companies have renounced production. There are some holdouts, though, like Alliant Tech Systems in Minnesota. One of Alliant's key arguments is that we will stop making these and we will stop, you know, we will vow not to do this in the future when the Pentagon stops ordering them. And the kind of mines which the United States is here in Oslo trying to protect, you know, the volcano mine, the MOPIMS mine, which is a multiple delivery mine system, and the Gator mine, some of them are made by companies like Alliant Tech Systems, and if they manage to get continued use of these mines into the treaty, we're presuming that that means continued production, continued export. Well, we have an export ban, but continuing to build up our stockpile, and we already have 1 million
now,
these presets.
The report that came out said that in terms of the U.S. argument that it protects U.S. soldiers, in fact, they gave some astronomical figure of U.S. soldiers who've been killed by U.S. landmines.
Yeah, that was another report which we just came out because we were anticipating this, you know, this problem with Korea. And we actually got through Senator Leahy's office a whole lot of documents from the Pentagon, which we gave to a researcher who then went through them and looked, and it was historical documents of the use of mines in certain conflicts like Vietnam and like Korea. And when he started going through these documents, the researcher was just simply startled at some of the statistics in there. Like, you know, we've found from these documents in the Pentagon's, the report is called In Its Own Words, we've found that a third of our casualties in Vietnam were because of anti-personnel mines. And we've found that of those mines which our troops were standing on, 90% of them were American-made or came from components, from American-made components.
So what are you suggesting that U.S. citizens do right now?
Right now, I would like them to call President Clinton. There is a call-in week going on, which Peace Action and a number of grassroots organizations have been doing a lot of work to promote, into the White House hotline, which is 202-456-1111.
That's 202-456-1111.
And please call and say you would like it to go on record that you support a ban on anti-personnel landmines because these weapons kill innocent civilians. And you want the United States to support an international ban. You want them to support a true ban treaty and not a treaty with exceptions, with loopholes, or with reservations, because that's what our diplomats here in Oslo are going after. And we need to combat that right now.
And Mary Wareham, if people want to get more information on the international campaign to ban landmines, where can they call? Where can they go on the web?
I'd suggest visiting this website, which is www.vvaf.org. That is my employee, the Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation, which is what VVAF stands for. And through there, you will find the websites for the international, the U.S. campaigns, and a link through to our conference website here in Oslo.
And for computer illiterates or people who don't have access to the computer, phone number?
We do have a 1-888 number, not a 1-800
number. A toll-free number.
Yeah, 1-888-BAN-MINES.
That's
1-888-BAN-MINES.
1-888-BAN-MINES. Well, Mary Wareham, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We will revisit the conference before it is over. It is going on for 19 days in Oslo, Norway. This is the conference, the crucial talks on the treaty outlawing anti-personnel landmines, which maim an estimated or kill 26,000 people a year. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. I'm reading from a quote from the last issue of The Nation magazine. It was the issue that came right until September 1st, yesterday, Labor Day. It says, however carefully you scan that shrink-wrapped so-called underground CD, the one you bought at Borders or Sam Goody, you may not know that you've just given several dollars to a multinational that also makes harm missiles, say, or floods the inner cities with cheap wine. That's an article by Mark Crispin Miller called Who Controls the Music? And it's part of an entire issue of The Nation magazine by that title that deals with the national entertainment state. The increasing concentration of corporate power in fewer hands has come to impact virtually every aspect of our daily life. Not spared from the onslaught has been what we hear. In recent years, the music industry has undergone wave after wave of consolidation that has now left six multinational combines largely responsible for what we hear. Along with the growing concentration of power has been a growing commercialization of the music business. Musicians and artists that once depended upon a rebel image to sell records and win popularity are increasingly going corporate. David Bowie sells bonds and Sheryl Crow sponsors Tommy Hilfiger while on tour. Well, as I said, The Nation magazine recently published this entire issue on the music industry called Who Controls the Music? And we're going to talk with some of the writers in that issue today. We're joined by Elena Umano, who is a freelance journalist and the Jamaican music correspondent for Billboard magazine. And we're joined by Armin White, the author of the book The Resistance, 10 Years of Pop Culture That Shook the World. He's also about to publish a biography of Tupac Shakur called Rebel for the Hell of It. And we're joined by my co-host Bernard White today, who is a co-host with me on Pacifica Station WBI in New York, the morning show there called Wake Up Call. Welcome, everyone.
Good morning.
Hi, Bernard.
Okay, how are you? Well, you know, Amy, I became interested in, I've always been interested in this issue. Because when I was growing up, there were a lot of musicians that I was really fond of who made a lot of music, and I didn't find out until I was an adult that they made no money. And this begins to talk about who controls the music and how that whole process takes place. And it seems that, it's still in effect where artists aren't making money. A lot of very talented artists aren't, we don't hear them anymore. because of the industry's control. And so I found this Nation article quite fascinating, and some of the folks who are deeply involved in bringing it together are here with us.
Well, why don't we begin with Armand White? Your piece in The Nation magazine is called On the Charts, Off the Covers, Rockism, Racism, and Rap. Mm. Who's on? Well, this is a rhetorical question, but who's on the charts and off the covers?
Well, this has always been true about popular music, but it's become especially apparent lately that the most popular music in America and across the world is music made by black artists. If you check out the Billboard Top 10 charts of contemporary pop music, and the singles chart especially, usually no fewer than 8 out of the top 10 singles are always by black artists or acts that contain black performers in them, black identified artists. And yet, when you look at the music press always promotes a different kind of popular music. And what you have is you have a contradiction here, a contradiction between what's actually popular, the music that people actually listen to and live by, and the music that our media culture fosters and promotes. The only explanation for it is that word that some people are afraid to use. It's racism, frankly. But this is a paradox that people are aware of but don't often talk about. So I was happy that The Nation gave me the chance to write about this issue.
One of the things in your article that just kind of it has like flashing lights on it, is that from Entertainment Weekly to Rolling Stone, no black artist's album has ever been chosen the best of the year.
Isn't that wild?
I found that amazing.
It's incredible. As one who always follows the popular music scene ever since I was a teenager, when you look at these magazines and newspapers and you read their critics' polls, you read their end-of-the-year lists and their end-of-decade assessments, it's just strange. Great black musicians, great black artists, and great albums and records are always dissed, always ignored when it comes to bestowing honors. It's just a further indication of the way pop criticism works, usually. Black artists are not considered, sort of like what happens with athletes as well. They're not considered intellects. They're just considered people who work off inspiration, instinct, and happenstance. And the sad fact of never choosing a black artist as Artist of the Year or a black record as a good record of the year is an indication that critics don't take black artists seriously as intellectuals, as conscious, creative artists.
Mm-hmm. How does this work? How does the industry begin to ignore these artists?
Well, it works the way a lot of things work. One of the purposes of capitalism, I guess you have to say, is not just simply to oppress others and exploit others for the benefit of a few, but it's also expressing a certain kind of ideology, and that ideology is that there are some people who are better than others. I think that's what it comes from, simply.
And when you were doing this piece, how do the editors, how do the publicists defend this?
Well, I've been working on a piece like this for a long time, especially during the years when I was at the City Sun, and it's hard to get people to talk about it, actually. So by the time I got to this Nation piece, I figured I needed a different approach. And the approach I took was this time, instead of concentrating on editors and writers who I know and have talked to over the years, I decided to talk to publicists, because when it comes to getting press for black artists, the publicists who represent black artists are probably even more frustrated than the artists, because they work hard to get coverage and then they often cannot get it, or the coverage that they can get is usually limited and biased. So the article focuses on a lot of the insights that publicists have about the way the music industry works with the publishing industry in representing black popular music. And for those who read the article, they'll see that a strange thing happened in my investigation of the story, that the publicists were willing to talk, but none of them wanted to be identified, because they were all afraid of some sort of industry backlash, of losing their jobs or losing their clout with editors. So none of them wanted to be identified, and I happily protected their identities. But it's an indication of how serious this issue is, that nobody wants to put their names on the records to talk about it.
Armand White is who you're listening to. He's one of the contributors to the Nation magazine's issue on who controls the music. And in the background, Dr. Dre with No Diggity from the CD no Black doubt. Street.
Play on, play it. Play on, play it. Yo, Dre dropped the verse.
It's going down, fade to Black Street. The homies got at me, collab creations. Bump like agony, no doubt. I put it down, never slouch. As long as my credit can vouch, a dog couldn't catch me. Say, tell me who could stop with Dre making moves, attracting honeys like a magnet, giving them orgasms with my mellow accent. Still moving this flavor with the homies Black Street and Teddy, the original Rough Shakers.
Shutting it down, good lord. Baby got them open all over town. Strictly bitch, you don't play around. Cover much grounds, got game by the pound. Getting paid is a forte. Each and every day, true play away. I can't get her out of my mind.
Wow.
I think about the girl all the time.
Wow, wow.
East side to the west side.
What happens to a tune like this when it hits the market?
Day, true play away. I can't get her out of my mind.
Wow.
I think about the girl all the time.
Wow, wow.
East side to the west side.
What happens to a tune like this when it hits the market? It's a little different. How do they go about maintaining control of their what has become known now as product? It's not music anymore, it's product.
Well, first, Bernard, you can't talk about No Diggity with just saying how gorgeous it is every time you hear it. Just a great, beautiful record, but according to pop critics, not the best record of the year. But anyway, how does the control happen? The control happens with some experience and knowledge about what it means to work in business and how to protect your interests. And I think it all comes down to that contract you sign and what you have enough foresight to put into the contract. If you're not savvy that way or don't have an agent who is savvy for you, then you get rooked, you get taken. And the only way to maintain any kind of control, even a modicum of control, is to have it contractually stated that you got it. Some artists have that savvy. Most don't. It may come with experience if you don't have it already. But if you don't take that precaution at the beginning, then you're exploited, mm-hmm. frankly.
And a lot of these young folks, I remember many of them used to come up to the radio station, play my demo, you know. Mm-hmm. So they're just interested in getting that song out into the public and will pretty much sign anything to do that.
Yeah, and it's a particular kind of knowledge that's required, because even a group as conscientious and politically minded as Public Enemy did not until about 5 years ago own its own publishing. Apparently they didn't even know how important that was when they first got their deal. So,
well, let's describe how important that is.
Well, if you own your publishing, that it's sort of like a pension, actually, because after you can't sing anymore, after you can't crawl into the studio, after your records stop selling, other people may sell, or may re-record them, or the record company that publishes your record may keep reprinting your records. And if you own the publishing, that guarantees that you will continue to be paid for it, even if you don't work yourself any longer. That's crucial. Also, from a writer's standpoint, you need to own what you do. You need to own your work. People don't seem to understand, or they just don't realize that when you work for any kind of publisher, any kind of publication, and that includes a record label, which publishes music, you need to control your work and just simply use the publisher as a vehicle for getting your work to the public. But you ought to own what you do.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of own what you do, a little Public Enemy.
There are more records of slave ships than one would dream. It seems inconceivable until you reflect that for 200 years ships sailed carrying cargoes of slaves.
Non-violent. In the face of the violence that we've been experiencing for the past 400 years, is actually doing our people a disservice. In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums!
So the people give you some of that reaction to the facts that I kick in the
Public Enemy, Can't Trust It is the name of this. Armin White, your comments on Public Enemy and how it fits into this picture of who controls the music.
Well, I don't want to follow Can't Trust It without saying how magnificent that record is, too. But another important issue that Public Enemy brings up, I think they're probably the most innovative and impressive American popular music act, that, in my opinion, in the past 10 years or so. And their fortunes with the public, and especially with the media, have been quite unfortunate, actually. They've become victims of the media, frankly. They've been attacked in the media and largely disrespected because of the political views they take. And what happens in the media, as I try to point out in the article, is that when critics don't like what you say, they try to dismiss you. And Public Enemy recently in the press has been considered, written about as if they were obsolete and as if their artistic innovations and their political content no longer mattered. And that's one of the horrible things that have happened in contemporary pop music journalism. Same thing has happened to Michael Jackson too. This kind of attack seems to occur whenever black artists get too powerful, too big, or too disturbing.
Elena Mano also joins us, in addition to Armin White, author of The Resistance. Elena Mano, freelance journalist specializing in music, Billboard magazine's Jamaican music correspondent. Her piece is called Reggae Says No to Politics. How? Let's take actually a little listen.
If you are living in a marketplace and you're no buyer or seller, yourself left in space, subject to be bought or sold. If you are living in a tenant yard and you are not the landowner, you'll get that notice from your landlord to leave sooner or later. So what you need is
liberation.
Everyone need it.
Liberation.
The young and old need
liberation.
Let's come together for the
This is Bunny Wailer, along with Bob Marley and Peter Tosh, made history as the Wailers, reggae's greatest supergroup. Fit this into the whole
music
scene here.
The world's greatest supergroup.
From their CD.
Ever. Well, what he's saying there obviously fits right into what Armin was saying. If you're not a buyer or a seller, you're going to get taken. Obviously, he's advocating liberation through economic control, which historically in the Jamaican music business has been lacking sorely for the artists. There are plenty of former superstars, and it wasn't that long ago that they were superstars in the 70s, who were walking around Jamaica without, as they say, next pair of pants, because they didn't receive royalties and they certainly didn't own their publishing. That's been a recent cause of concern, and there's been a lot of activity about that in the last few years. Some of the same people, however, the producers who rooked them in the first place are forming the publishing companies. But there are some people there who are actually getting that control.
How did reggae sneak through? Because its message is such a strong message, it seems like it would have been suppressed.
Well, first of all, a lot of people don't understand patois, you know, once so they don't know what the lyrics are
saying. As soon as they understood it, they stopped it.
It's happened. Well, I mentioned in my article that Bob Marley had amassed a nice CIA file, or they amassed it on him. So, and there are some people who feel that his death was deliberate on the part of those who were afraid of what he was saying.
Hmm. Before we get back to your article, you raise an interesting point. And that is about controlling the culture. These folks who run these industries actually play a big role in controlling and directing the culture.
Which industries? The record
industry? Well,
industries.
In the record industry.
Are you speaking of Jamaica or here?
Jamaica and as well as here.
Well, the situation in Jamaica is different than the situation here in certain ways. I mean, just to summarize, in Jamaica, it's still a matter of, you go in the studio, you make a record, you don't expect to make money from the record unless you get sales outside of Jamaica. You make your money from doing shows. But unfortunately, what usually happens is still happening is the same person who produced the record is the label owner, is the manager, is the booker. Over here, it's a directly opposite situation. You make your money from the records if you make it. You tour for the record, not to make money, but to support the record and have the sales and get paid a little bit later on down the road. But somehow or other, even though those two systems seem to be different, there's only the big money man who gets the money on both sides of the ocean. Mm-hmm. It seems to work out that way, as opposed to the artist.
Elena, we're going to come back to Jamaican music, which produces more music per capita perhaps than any country in the globe, as you point out in your piece in The Nation magazine, a whole issue devoted to who controls the music. Elena Umano is the Jamaican music correspondent for Billboard magazine. Armand White is also with us, author of The Resistance, 10 Years of Pop Culture That Shook the World. And we come back, we'll be joined also by Vaughn Martin. Vaughn Martin, who is a broadcast journalist with the Organization of American States and also with Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, D.C., to talk about carnival around this country and the history of it as we're just in the midst of it right now. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in just a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, heard from Hawaii to Maine, from Washington to Florida, New York to California, and all sorts of cities in between, like Minneapolis and Boulder, Colorado. We are joined by Elena Umano, who's a freelance journalist and Jamaican music correspondent for Billboard magazine, as well as Armand White, author of The Resistance, 10 Years of Pop Culture That Shook the World. And he just has a book about coming out on Tupac Shakur called Rebel for the Hell of It. Vaughn Martin is also with us from Washington, D.C. He works with the Organization of American States as a producer at WPFW Pacifica Radio, where he hosts a show every Saturday evening. Elena Umano, I should also say I'm with Bernard White, who's my co-host here today, who I'd say this is one of his specialties, looking at music around the world, music and politics.
Certainly I'm interested in it. Elena Umano, in your article, Reggae Says No to Politics, you talk about how political parties in Jamaica have begun to use this music, this reggae music.
Well, they haven't begun to. They always did. I mean, most notably, Michael Manley, when he borrowed Better Must Come from Delroy Morgan and used that as his slogan to oust the JLP party. But after a certain amount of disenchantment with Manley's government, Better Not Come Yet, as they say, and it's 1997, and the musicians are refusing to allow them to do this, but I wrote in the article about an instance where the JLP was having some kind of televised conference, and in the background, playing softly, was a tune that's been a big hit from Tony Rebel, who's a DJ, Sing Jay, and the tune is If Ja Is Standing By My Side. So, of course, he had not given permission for them to use this. He was furious. I told him about it, and he was furious. Because the implication was that Ja is standing by the JLP side, and Tony Rebel is right there with them. So I don't think Jamaican politicians are the only one to do that.
This reminds me of Bobby McFerrin and George Bush, right? Don't worry, be happy.
Don't worry, get a lobotomy.
And he adopted his song. But what about the history of reggae music in Jamaica, where it comes from?
Well, Jamaicans are pretty much considered to be the rebels of the Caribbean nations. I think they take a lot of pride in that. And the rebel of the mothers of all rebels were the Maroons, although there were Maroons on other Caribbean islands. These were slaves who escaped the plantations and made for the hills in the interior. And so their drumming, coro drumming, and the abang horn were really the first political pieces of music, and the slaves on the plantation below would hear them. And that was the first political music, I think, in Jamaica. But, you know, there's a tradition in the Caribbean, same thing in Trinidad, Tobago, and other countries, of using, let's say, calypso to comment on the news of the day, to speak of the desires and the needs of the people on the national life. So that's not something new. In Jamaica, I think, even ska, which came about during independence from England in 1962, was a very buoyant, happy music. But then very soon, as people came from the country to Kingston City for work, and things were not working out so wonderfully as they expected after independence, there was a sour note, disillusionment that crept into the lyrics, like "You Wicked Old Jezebel," referring to the Queen in a 1962 ska piece, Justin Hines and the Dominoes. And then when Rastafari came into the picture, then the music completely took on political, social overtones. It was almost completely about that until the 80s, when various influences turned the music more into a dance hall, guns and girls type of thing. And now it's back to consciousness, but apolitical.
I wanted to bring Vaughn Martin into this discussion, and I thought no better way to introduce him than with the Mighty Sparrow.
You send a whole damn deck. You ain't drunk. You have been drinking. Say yeah.
Yeah.
Say yeah.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. But when you drink that West India rum and you drink it fast, then you reach for your woman and you miss her. You're drunk. You're drunk. You're drunk and disorderly.
Drunk and disorderly. Always in custody, me friends and me family. All man fed up with me, cause I'm drunk and disorderly.
Every weekend I'm in the jail.
Drunk and disorderly. Nobody to stand me bail.
Drunk and disorderly. Always in custody. All man fed up with me.
That's Mighty Sparrow singing Drunk and Disorderly. And before we go to Vaughn, Elaine Umano, you want to get in a comment?
I just want to say for Sparrow that that's his party, you know, persona. He's also written and sung some amazing anthemic black liberation songs.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like a Bob Marley.
Well, there was all sorts of things going on yesterday on the Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn, New York, where the largest celebration of really Caribbean culture takes place in this country. About something like 2 million people come down to the Parkway, and it happens every day, every year on Labor Day. Vaughn Martin had come down to New York yesterday from Washington, come up to New York, to be there on the Parkway, a broadcast journalist who produces a show for WPFW Pacifica Radio every Saturday evening called Caribbeana.
Yes, Caribbeana has been going on for the past 20 years on WPFW,
one of the
founding programs. I must also point out to the significance of music, which my brother and sister have been talking about. To Carnival, music was the main ingredient which carried the revelers or carried the demonstrators forth in their expressions of Carnival. In New York yesterday, it was just fantastic to see over these 2 million people on Eastern Parkway, and at the same time whining and gyrating and having a ball to the music, they were demonstrating as well and talking about the Haitian brother Louima and all these things, and they protested to the police as well while they were demonstrating. So again, Carnival is a most significant reality in our lives, and we use it to demonstrate that.
Mm. Do the Calypsonians have the same fate as the rest of popular music? Do they also have to struggle to get there, to get reimbursed for what it is they do?
Of course, I think it's worse. It's worse than our brothers and sisters on this side. Number one, Caribbean music or calypso is not heard very much in Trinidad. It's a seasonal music. the minute of music, a song, let's say a Dr. Dre is released here or it's about to be released, you can easily say it's released in Trinidad the day before. That's the kind of network and the international network that exists. The music, the big moguls of music, certainly link the outside world much more effectively and in the Caribbean. So we find a lot of the music is being heard out there before here. Calypsos get an opportunity to be heard around Carnival time. Just recently, there was one radio station, one out of about 12, who got on the air and was promoting, that's Tempo 105, promoting Caribbean music in general. But beyond that, they're very difficult. Men have to give away their talents. For a Calypsonian to get a record, he has to get a producer who will front the money for him. He goes in the studio, and he can certainly looking back on whether he gets any remuneration. Recently, the Copyright Organization of Trinidad and Tobago, just about 5 years ago, got into the business of copywriting and trying to replenish artists or get monies from artists who had recordings outside and so on to sort of compensate people.
Vaughn Martin, tell us a little about Carnival in this country. While New York's is the largest that took place yesterday, how many take place?
Well, there's over 40 cities right now celebrating carnivals in North America. In Florida alone, you have got about 8 of them. In New York, there are about 4 or 5 of them. Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, they all have carnivals. New York, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, they're all there. Wherever West Indian people reside, they take this cultural expression with them and they celebrate it. Part of the problem that exists is organization, management, and money. The people who make the money, they do not come from the community themselves. And that's part of the difficult thing that we find in the growing carnivals.
Isn't that the major problem with the record industry? That's what you're writing about, Armin. You, Elena, that the people who control this industry have no relationship to the communities from which this music, this culture is coming from, and they make decisions based on their own personal culture.
Oh, it's in the case of reggae, it's just amazing. You know, they have absolutely no concept of what's going on there. It's like native music to some of these people. Even sometimes when they're working with African American record execs, because it's a different culture and they may not be into reggae, the executive might, so they really don't have a clue as to what the music's about and what's good. I mean, like the two people who made some impact as far as record sales, Shabba Ranks, and Armin wore a Shabba Ranks t-shirt in honor of me today. And Patra were really treated like jokes, and you know, and they were marketed for their salaciousness. Mm-hmm. And Patra never made a name in Jamaica. She was sort of plucked by a specialist or producer from the studio. You know, he was the only one who ever recorded. Nobody knew who she was. Shabba, however, was a really good DJ, and he really got packaged as a kind of a sex joke, as a dirty joke. And that's not what reggae is about. It's extremely insulting.
Yeah, one reason I wanted to concentrate on the role that the media played was to build up in people's minds the connection between media and the music industry. Because the media, the press, often acts as a conduit for what the industry wants to promote, with the images and the ideology that the industry decides it wants to sell, that it wants the ideas that it wants to distract the public with. And often those ideas are simply based on salaciousness, as Elena said, rather than political ideas. Just about every artist you can think of is always exploited for something unsubstantial. And this happens most horribly with black artists. It happens, as Elena says, in the way reggae artists are promoted. And in America, it happens in the way that rap artists, especially rap artists who have something social to say, are promoted. The industry uses the media to sell these artists not as thinking political people, but as sex acts, usually.
Mm-hmm. Will you fit Tupac Shakur into this, who you're writing a biography about?
Oh, absolutely. And the horror of that is that Tupac came from a very conscious background and was conscious himself. But, you know, by the time Tupac got into the music industry and by the time he started making records in the early 90s, this mechanism that the industry had, that the record industry had for using the media to promote images of black people that the industry wanted to sell was well in effect, and it overwhelmed Tupac himself.
Do you see any? Yes, Vaughn.
We have in Trinidad two artists who are getting packaged within the whole black music scene. That's Michelle Montano and General Grant. And they seem to be going down very well, but not getting the right kind of marketing that they could get. Mm-hmm. And they are also traveling in sort of caravans with the carnivals as they go through. So again, we're seeing this question of big money being made, whether it's through the artists or through the activities of a carnival throughout North America that's happening.
Do you see any people who've been able to beat out the moguls, the record companies actually control what they put out? Are there any examples that any of you see?
Well, there is Prince, who in effect has had to leave the mainstream music industry and basically become an independent, a high profile independent. That's really about the only way you can get absolute control over what you do in the music industry.
In the case of reggae, in the last 2 years or so, there's been, since the debacle of these reggae artists being dropped by majors, marketed so poorly, it's ridiculous, not given a chance when they've delivered wonderful records to these majors, they're really not even looking that much for major deals anymore, as some are, of course, but the trend is away from that. The trend is almost like they're saying, well, the hell with America. We can sell in the Orient, we can sell in Europe, and they're doing their own deals. At MIDEM, which is the annual music convention in Cannes, France, international, everybody shows up. The Jamaicans had the opening night concerts, two simultaneous concerts, and a lot of other activity. The whole Quasette was taken over by Jamaicans. They took over the Whiskey A Go-Go, Stone Love, which is a sound system, played there, and they were making their deals with Europeans. You know, a lot of the executives came there, and the Japanese, and so on and so forth. And they're no longer looking for the majors to make their careers, because it just doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say perhaps Prince has stumbled on a way to beat it. It seems that he's going to go up on the internet with his piece.
Yeah, well, he's working out a way to beat it. But probably I would also like to point out to people that one of the most interesting things that happen in the music industry are those artists who know how to deal, as Elena says. That's an important word. And someone who does is certainly Michael Jackson, who has a great deal of control over what he does. But even despite the control that Jackson has got, even he runs into certain kinds of trouble. Because the most recent record he's made, this thing called Blood on the Dance Floor, History in the Remix, happens to be a very political album. And it also happens to be the album that the music journalists in America, at least, have ignored the most and have disdained the most. But Jackson's a good example of knowing how to deal so that you can say exactly what you want to say and make the kind of money that you need to make in the industry just to sustain yourself. But it takes a lot of intelligence and smarts and courage and struggle.
Well, we thought we'd go out today with Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. A comment on them as we go out with their music, The Message?
Well, The Message is a great song, always worth hearing, and because it's been a bedrock for a lot of rap artists, it's a song whose ideas need to be refreshed in people's minds all the time.
I think it's still the best rap ever.
You think CBS, PolyGram, Warner, or MCA, or that they're going to push this kind of message?
If they can find a way to sell it, you know, it's an immoral, an amoral industry, I would say, before it's an immoral industry.
Well,
it's both. But if they can find a way to sell it, they'll push it.
Armin White, thanks for joining us, author of Resistance, 10 Years of Pop Culture That Shook the World. Vaughn Martin, producer at WPFW Pacifica Station in Washington of Caribbeana for the last 20 years. And Elena Umano, freelance journalist and Jamaican music correspondent for Billboard magazine. And Bernard, thanks for being with us. Bernard White of WBAI in New York. This is Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five.
It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
Yeah. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland engineered today's show. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far, cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Standing on the front stoop, hanging out the window, watching all the cars go by, roaring as the breezes blow.